Last week we got as far in the book of John, don't turn to John, we got as far in the book of John as Jesus before Pontius Pilate. And we talked about some of the political intrigue and background involved in Jesus standing before Pilate. But again, John assumes in his writing, he assumes that you've already read Matthew, Mark, Luke, some combination thereof. And so if there's information that the other three have already covered, oftentimes John will just skip over that and then give us the information that the others left out. And so we're going to spend a little time this morning looking at Matthew, Mark, and Luke's account of Jesus before Pilate, because each of them include little bits of information that the others don't. For instance, start in Matthew 27. That'll be a good place to begin. Matthew, for instance, tells us something that the other three don't. Pontius Pilate's wife had a dream about Jesus. You would know that if Matthew hadn't added that little bit of information. So let's start at chapter 27, verse 1. Now when morning had come, all the chief priests and the elders of the people took counsel against Jesus to put him to death. For what cause? They hated him. That was their only cause. They had nothing against him. He was completely innocent. They didn't have a charge they could lay against him. And this is why they're going to the Romans. They're going to try to charge him with some form of trying to overthrow Rome. Verse 2, and they bound him, and they led him away, and they delivered him up to Pilate, the governor. Then when Judas, who had betrayed him, saw that he had been condemned, he felt remorse, and he returned the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and to the elders. John doesn't tell us that. Matthew does. He tells us that when Judas realized what was happening, he felt remorse for what he had done. Now that's an interesting little fact, because listen to what he does with the money. Then when Judas, who had betrayed him, saw that he had been condemned, he felt remorse and returned the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priest and the elders, saying, I have sinned by betraying innocent blood. But they said, what is that to us? See to that yourself. And he threw the pieces of silver into the sanctuary and departed. And he went away and he hung himself. And the chief priests took the silver and said, it's not lawful to put them into the temple treasury, since it is the price of blood. Now, you remember last week, they were very careful not to go into the court of Pontius Pilate, because that was a Gentile court, and they wanted to stay clean so that they could participate in the Passover. In other words, they were so busy making sure that they kept the details of the law that they couldn't recognize that what they were doing was even less lawful, even worse, even more sinister, in that they were killing an innocent man. They were killing the Son of God. As we heard read this morning, Alan read that Peter said to the Israelites, you with wicked hands crucified the Prince of Life. Here they are again doing the same thing. They're responsible for the killing of the innocent one, but look at what they're worried about. When they get their 30 pieces of silver back, they go, oh, what are we going to do with it? We can't put it in the treasury because it's blood money now, so we can't put it in the treasury. They're worried about the proper distribution of money while they're busy killing the Prince of Life. They couldn't be more wrong-headed at this moment. If you ever needed proof, yet again, that the Bible teaches the depravity of human beings, here's another perfect example. You know they were walking around with their heads up, talking about what they were going to do with this money, talking about how important it was that they handle the money correctly. But did you know that in the Old Testament, it was already prophesied what they were going to do with the blood money? Here again, everything is falling into place exactly as God said it would. I've been emphasizing for the last several weeks that Jesus never stopped being in control through all of these events. The picture that you get of him in the movies and the TV shows is that he's a poor, pathetic weakling who ended up a victim of Rome's dominance, and that between the Jews and the Romans. There was just nothing he could do. They finally overwhelmed him. They finally got him. And he's just this pathetic creature being led to the slaughter. Nothing like that in the Bible. In the Bible, he's in complete control, and everything that happens to him is predicted, is prophesied, and is happening exactly the way God said it would. So what did they do with the money? And they counseled together, and with the money, they bought a potter's field as a burial place for strangers. Now, this is really interesting. As if everything else in here isn't interesting. This is really interesting. Did they do what they wanted to do according to their own counsel and apparent free will?
Yes. No.
It's fun to watch the room drift.
That's a correct answer. Yes and no.
Did they do what they wanted to do?
No.
Yes, they did what they wanted to do.
They did what they wanted to do. They counseled together and they did what they wanted to do. And what did they do? Exactly what God said they would do. Exactly what was prophesied in advance they would do. Did they have any choice except do what they did? But I thought you just said they did what they wanted to do. They did exactly what they wanted to do. They counseled together and did what they wanted to do. And they did exactly what God said they were going to do. This, my friends, is sovereignty. By the way, were any of these men who did this saved men?
No.
There's no indication that any of these men were saved. In fact, these are the very ones that Jesus said things like, how will you escape the fire of hell, where the worm never sleeps, where the fire is never quenched? He called them a den of vipers. He said, you are of your father the devil, and you will always do your father's bidding. He condemned these men. We know that these are not saved saints looking to do the will of God. These are wicked men. These are evil men doing exactly what they want to do and doing exactly what God said they would do. You see, for God to be really genuinely sovereign, then everything in his universe must serve his purposes. Has to. We have a difficult time with that because as long as we think of God as only being in control of the good stuff, then when the bad stuff happens, it seems like an aberration. This will be fun. Anybody here ever had a problem in their life? Be okay. That'd be everybody. Yeah, we've all had problems in our lives. And depending on how you've been raised and what you've been taught, it's real common for people to reach that point of trouble in their life and ask questions like, where's God? Why didn't God save me from this? Why didn't God keep me from this? Or as Charlie is saying, why me? She's mouthing, why me, up here in the front. Because Charlie knows the right answer to why me is,
why not you?
Part of living human life is that trouble comes. Bad things happen. Sometimes you are going to have encounters with people who do not have your best interest at heart. And you're going to wonder, you're going to think, well, God could have kept me out of that. God could have made me avoid that. God could have stopped that person from doing that. And yet he didn't. And so the only thing we can conclude is that a good and a wise and a loving sovereign God let that occur in your life because it serves his purpose. And that really, really helps when you're going through the stuff that makes you ask, why me? Why am I going through this? The answer is always the same. I get a lot of email. I can say that sentence any way you'd like. I get a lot of email. And there are some themes that are just common to my email. And one of them is something bad happened. People want to share that. They want to tell somebody. They want to unburden themselves. And so they write to me. And they tell me about the bad stuff that happens. And sometimes I get done reading my email And it's just as depressing as it can be. I don't know how else to say it. I get to the end of a stack of email, and sometimes it's all people saying, I've lost my job, and I'm going through trouble, or I've lost a mate, or I've lost a loved one, or somebody died, or something, my child is sick, or there's a lot of bad news out there. And they come and they want comfort. They want me to tell them something that will help them. And I tell them the same thing every time. God's on his throne, doing whatever seems good to him. He didn't stop being God, and he didn't fall off his throne when you had a problem. And the more you understand and the more you recognize his absolute sovereignty in your situation, the more you will understand that your situation has a purpose. And once you know that there's a purpose to it, it's easier to endure because God is getting glory for himself. And once you get a hold of that, then even in the worst of times, you can say, God's going to be God. He's going to do what he's going to do. And you're better off getting on his side in it than fighting him through it. Here you have in verse 7, here you have evil, wicked men counseling together to do something that would appear to be kind of random. I mean, remember Solomon who wrote, the lot is cast into the lap, and the whole disposing thereof is of the Lord. Casting lots is like throwing dice, flipping a coin, something completely random from our perspective. And yet, we read in the Bible that even something that small is in God's control. And so in order to demonstrate the kind of control he has, he wrote in advance what the evil men were going to do with the money that was the cost of Jesus' betrayal. That ought to make you go, wow. That ought to just absolutely amaze us. Because God is in that kind of control, and that means he's in control of what's happening to you too. Jesus argued that. Jesus talked about sparrows falling from the sky. Said, aren't two sparrows sold in the market for a farthing? I mean, it's half a penny. It's nothing. And he says, and yet not a one of them can fall from the sky without your Father. He compared the grass. And he said, behold the lilies of the field. Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. So if God took the time to clothe the grass and to take care of the birds, won't he much more take care of you? Well, yeah, the answer is yeah. I try to remind people when they're going through their difficulty and they say, where's God? I say, he would be the same one who put clothes on your back today. He's the same one who put food in your stomach today. He's the same one who put breath in your nostrils and a thought in your brain. He's the one that kept your heart beating today. You know where he is? He's on his throne, doing whatever seems good to him. You see, he was seated on his throne, divinely, sovereignly doing whatever he wanted when he poured out his cumulative wrath on his son. He was still doing what he wanted to do. And you think that your troubles are greater than that? The writer of Hebrews says, you have not yet resisted unto blood, striving against sin. How many of you here so far have actually bled for your sin? He did. He bled for your sin. You haven't reached that point yet. I don't care how bad it's gotten for you. Some of us have had a real rough road. Sometimes it's tough. But the same God who purchased you by pouring out his wrath on his son is the same God who said, I'll never leave you, I'll never forsake you. That's real sovereignty, but it's also real comforting. And so that's the God who made sure that they would counsel together. With the money, they bought a potter's field. Let's talk about what a potter's field is. One of the ways that archaeologists have been able to trace the wanderings of the children of Israel is by the broken pottery they left in their wake, because they were very good, very skilled at making small furnishings and bowls and cups and pans and things to eat out of clay. And they would fire the clay and it would get hard and they could use it for a while. And when it broke, they just left it behind because they didn't have Elmer's glue. And so they would just leave it. If it was broken, you'd leave it. Well, once you've established a city like Jerusalem, you can't just leave the garbage laying around. And so there were particular areas designated where you could throw away your broken stuff. And usually it was a field. It was one field that was always burning and full of worms, and it was where you threw your refuse, and it was called Gehenna. And that's the reference that Jesus used to explain that his hell was even worse than that. But then there was another field where you would take your broken pottery and be able to throw it away. Because remember, broken pottery, sharp, could cut you, you could get hurt on it. And so keep it off the streets, put it in a designated place. It's a potter's field. In other words, it's a field full of broken pottery.
Potsherds.
Now, it's interesting that Gladys would say that, because when she just said potsherds, she didn't mean pottery. Broken pottery is the language that is used for human beings in the Bible. Let the potsherds of the earth strive with the potsherds of the earth. What does that mean? That doesn't mean the pottery is fighting with each other. It means human beings are fighting with each other. Jeremiah was told by God, come talk to me, meet me at the potter's house. So Jeremiah goes to the potter's house, and God speaks to him and says, what do you see? And he says, I see the potter working a work on the wheel. And God says, I do that. He used the potter with his wheel as a visual aid to help Jeremiah understand God's sovereignty. And he said, watch the way the potter can mar something in his hand and then start over and make it any way he wants. He said, I do that with Israel. I make whatever I make on the wheel, and I make it the way I want to make it on the wheel. Well, then, Paul picks that up in Romans 9, and says that we are like pottery that's on a wheel. And he says, doesn't God have the right, out of the same lump of clay, to make one vessel for honor and another for dishonor? Now, that's, one more time, the language of pottery being used to describe human beings. Broken human beings, that would be us.
Amen.
I tell people all the time, I'm not looking for righteous humans. I'm not looking for beautiful vases. I'm looking for broken sinners. Because I got an answer for broken sinners. I got nothing to tell the righteous. I've met people before that just think they're so good that if they tripped and fell forward, they'd fall into heaven. I don't need them because they're a whole lot better than me. I got nothing for them. But send me broken pottery. I got an answer for them. Send me the sinners. Send me the depraved. I've got an answer for them. I can explain to them how they can be reconciled to their God, to their Maker. Now, way back in Zechariah, there was a prophecy. Turn to Zechariah 11. Keep your finger there in Matthew. Turn back to Zechariah 11, someone or everyone. Zechariah back in the Old Testament, among the prophets. Zechariah 11. Verses 12 and 13. So it's Zechariah 11, 12, 13. These are the mnemonic devices that help me remember things. Zechariah 11, verses 12 and 13. You got it? Who's got it? Raise your hand if you got it. Tom, you got it? You want to read it for us?
Sure.
Okay.
I told them, if you think it best, give me my pay, but if not, keep it. So they paid me 30 pieces of silver.
Wasn't that lucky? Wasn't that lucky? Wasn't 28, wasn't 32. That was lucky. Okay, go ahead.
And the Lord said to me, throw it to the potter. the handsome price at which they priced me. So I took the 30 pieces of silver and threw them into the house of the Lord to the potter.
Now look at the language. The price of a man, 30 pieces of silver, and I threw it to the potter, but I threw it into the house of the Lord to the potter. So what do? Judas comes in, gives them the 30 pieces of silver, takes it to the house of the Lord. What do? They take it to the potter, and they buy a potter's field. The price of the man on the cross ended up buying a field full of broken pots. That'd be us. That was not a coincidence, friends. That was the same sovereign God of history teaching over and over and over and over again. Now we're back in Matthew. So they counseled together, says verse 7 of chapter 27. And they counseled together, and with the money they bought a potter's field as a burial place for strangers. For this reason, that field has been called the field of blood to this day. Then that which was spoken through Jeremiah the prophet was fulfilled, saying, and they took the 30 pieces of silver, the price of the one whose price had been set by the sons of Israel, and they gave them for the potter's field as the Lord directed me. Now, in your text it'll say Jeremiah. What we just read was out of Zechariah. The first reference to a potter's field, as I told you, is in Jeremiah. This has caused no end of grief for commentators and no end of criticism for critics of the Bible. There are a couple different explanations for why Matthew wrote Jeremiah. There is not a textual variant there. It wasn't a scribal error there. It turns out that he actually wrote Jeremiah. And what he quoted was actually from Zechariah. The most common explanation. Well, let me give you my version of the explanation, then I'll give you the best explanation. The critics who criticize the Bible love to point out little variables in the Bible, especially between books of the Bible, or especially between the four Gospels. They'll say, well, you know, if you compare the four Gospels, they say different things about different events. And they try to use that as a criticism of the Bible to say the Bible's not true because over here Matthew says this and over here John says this. Why didn't they both say the same thing? Of course, if all four Gospels had said exactly and identically the same thing, then the critics would say, well, that can't be true. They're obviously just copying off each other. They got together in a room and made up the story and wrote the exact same thing. So we really are in a can't-win position. I contend that chances are Matthew had in mind the potter's house of Jeremiah while he quoted Zechariah, and so he made reference to Jeremiah. But there's an interesting little Hebraism we have to include here. The Old Testament is, in the Hebrew mind, divided up into three large portions. There's the law, there's the writings or the poetry books, and then there are the prophets. You've oftentimes seen Jesus refer to the Old Testament as the law and the prophets. Well, when you look at the way that the Hebrew Bible is constructed, the first book among the prophets is the book of Jeremiah. And so oftentimes in the Hebrew mind, a reference to the prophetic books was a reference to Jeremiah. The same way that anything in the first five books was just the Torah. Sometimes the poetic books were just called Psalms. So there's a possibility that Matthew did it on purpose and that he was just saying it's written in the prophets. And he mentioned Jeremiah and then quoted Zechariah. There's a possibility that he had the potter's house of Jeremiah in mind and combined that in his thinking, and so he referred to Jeremiah. My point is this. He did quote from the Old Testament prophets, and it was an accurate Old Testament prophecy. So even if someone wants to say, I thought the Bible was inspired, but he got the name wrong, I'm going to say, yeah, but he got the facts right. And the Bible still prophesied in advance that the cost, the 30 pieces of silver, the cost of Christ's death was going to buy you and me. You got it? Next time you can answer the critics when they come at you. Because they're going to. Verse 11. Now Jesus stood before the governor, and the governor questioned him, saying, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And Jesus said to him, "You said it." And while he was being accused by the chief priests and the elders, he made no answer. Then Pilate said to him, "Do you not hear how many things they testify against you?" And he did not answer him with regard to even a single charge, so that the governor was quite amazed. Now we understand why it is that when John records the conversation between Jesus and Pilate, it says that they went indoors privately to have that conversation. So he did fulfill Isaiah's prophecy that before his shearers, before the ones who were going to kill him, he was dumb. He didn't argue for himself. But in front of Pilate, in private, he had the conversation that we read last week. John and Matthew do not contradict each other. Two different situations, two different settings. Verse 15, now at the feast, the governor was accustomed to release for the multitude any one prisoner whom they wanted. And they were holding at that time a notorious prisoner named Barabbas. When therefore they were gathered together, Pilate said to them, "Whom do you want me to release for you, Barabbas or Jesus, who is called Christ or Messiah?" For he knew that because of envy the Jews had delivered him up. And while he was sitting on the judgment seat, his wife sent to him, saying, "Have nothing to do with that righteous man, for last night I suffered greatly in a dream because of him." Isn't that interesting? Matthew's the only one who recounts that. But Pilate didn't know that the next day he was going to have Jesus in front of him. He had no idea about that. And yet Pilate's wife, the night before, had a dream about him and that he was a righteous man and to have nothing to do with him. Now, last week I tried to emphasize to you that the Romans are superstitious people. They have lots of religion. They have a pantheon of gods. They have lots of myths. Most of you in your matriculating through school at some point had to read Roman mythology and Greek mythology, and they had a lot of gods that were like men that, you know, would have fights and take wives and have children and be jealous and all that stuff. Well, this is all in the mind of this Roman procurator and his wife. And so when she has a dream about a god man, it of course stirs up all of that mythological kind of thinking and all of that fear of the gods coming to the planet. And so she, of course, says, "Don't have anything to do with this righteous man." It's just fascinating that she had the dream before Pilate ever even saw Jesus. God making sure to plant all those seeds in advance that nothing was happening by mistake. But the chief priests and the elders persuaded the multitudes to ask for Barabbas and to put Jesus to death. So now we know why the crowd turned. This is another fascinating fact. This is the same group of people who a week earlier were throwing their robes and palm branches in the streets as Jesus rode into Jerusalem in what we call the triumphal entry, and they were crying out to him, "Hosanna to the Son of David." They were very excited to see him because they believed that if he was Messiah, if he was the Son of David, the next thing that happens is, here comes the kingdom. He's going to be the king. He's going to set up his kingdom. He's going to rule from Jerusalem. We're going to throw off the yoke of Rome. We're finally going to be that kingdom that all of our prophets have promised. This is the day. Here he comes. A week later, he's standing there beaten and bloodied in front of them, being mocked by the Romans. And when the Jewish leaders go into the crowd and say, "Ask for Barabbas," they turn on Jesus like that. Again, do you want an example of depravity? Now we have a better understanding of why they were crying in the streets, "Hosanna, son of David, Hosanna!" Because they were looking forward to what they were going to get out of it. I mean, what a good king! This is a guy who can feed 5,000 with a couple loaves and fishes. This is a guy who pays taxes by taking gold out of fishes' mouths. This is a really good king. And now here he is being judged by a Roman. Here he is in shackles with Roman guards. He's not being the king they wanted him to be. And so they turn on him. And they say, yeah, give us the thieving robber seditionist and kill Jesus because he really let us down. We were counting on him. And he did not overthrow the Romans, and he did not bring about the kingdom, and so we're really disappointed. Kill him. Now, by the way, even though, this is going to sound real familiar, even though it was the Jews going through the crowd, the Jewish leaders going through the crowd, and saying, ask for Barabbas, and then everybody chose Barabbas and said, crucify Jesus, were they all doing what they wanted to do?
They thought they were.
Tom goes for the middle line. I saw some people nodding. I saw some people, no.
The same answer as last time.
It's the same answer as last time. Yeah. These people were doing exactly what they wanted to do. We want him. We don't want him. We want Barabbas. We don't want Jesus. We're doing exactly what we want to do. And yet, they were doing exactly what Isaiah 53 said they were going to do. Exactly. They were making sure to mock him so that he would die, and he, in order to fulfill the everlasting covenant that he had with his father, had to die that day. They had to get busy. It had to happen quick. They had to have him on a cross that day because it's the Passover day. He has to be on the cross at the same time that people are killing their Passover lambs. This all has to happen by the divine ordinance and counsel of God. Remember what we read last week from Acts 4, was it? Acts 4:28. Does that sound familiar? Somebody look that up. That Herod and Pilate and the Jews and the Gentiles gathered together to do what? Whatever your hand and your counsel foreordained to be done. And they did exactly what they wanted to do. Did you find it over there, Tom?
Yeah, 4:28.
It was Acts 4:28?
That's right.
Oh, I'm going to be 55 soon, friends. And my memory is still working. I just want to point that out. Okay.
They did what your power and will had decided beforehand should happen.
Read the verse before it.
Indeed, Herod and Pontius Pilate met together with the Gentiles and the people of Israel in this city to conspire against your holy servant Jesus, whom you anointed. They did what your power and will had decided beforehand should happen.
So they did exactly what they wanted to do, right?
Right.
And they did exactly what God said they were going to do, right?
Right.
Right. Because God ordained every single thing that took place in order. It had to happen. It had to happen quickly. So even though Matthew recounts that the leaders were in the crowd saying, take Barabbas, they, though they weren't saved, though they were depraved, though they were doing the worst thing that's ever been done in human history, they were turning on the only innocent one, and they were doing exactly what God's determinate counsel predestined to be done. That's the sort of sovereignty I'm talking about. Pilate said to them, verse 22. Well, verse 21. But the governor answered and said to them, which of the two do you want me to release to you? And they said, Barabbas. Pilate said to them, then what shall I do with Jesus who is called Christ? And all said, let him be crucified. And he said, why? What evil has he done? But they kept shouting all the more, saying, let him be crucified. And when Pilate saw that he was accomplishing nothing, but rather a riot was starting, he took water and washed his hands in front of the multitude, saying, I am innocent of this man's blood. You see to it yourselves. See, Pilate wanted badly to get out of this thing. He's got his wife on one side saying, don't get in this. He has the private conversation with Jesus where Jesus is identified as the Son of God, and he doesn't want anything to do with that. He does not want it to go down in history that he's the one responsible for the death of Christ. Nevertheless, what Paul, see, I'm 55, and my memory is slipping. What Tom read for us a moment ago said Herod and Pilate and the Jews and the Gentiles were gathered together to do whatever your hand and counsel determined to be done, because even though Pilate was trying to not do it, he was doing it. Even though he was warned by his wife not to do it, he was doing it. Even though he seemed to understand the threat, when it reached the point where the mob was about to riot, and remember, this is Passover, everybody that can travel is in Jerusalem, this is a large mob, and the last thing he needs to go answer to Caesar for is a riot breaking out in Jerusalem on the feast day while he's in town. And he recognizes that if this riot happens, there's going to be no quelling this one, because these people are fired up and they want to overthrow Rome. So what does he do? He does exactly what God ordained he would do. And he didn't even want to. And Pilate saw that he accomplished nothing, but rather that a riot was starting, and he took water and he washed his hands in front of the multitude, saying, I am innocent of this man's blood. You see to it yourselves. And all the people answered and said, his blood be upon us and on our children. Any parents here willing to make that kind of vow? That's the level of hatred they had for him. That's how badly they wanted him gone. Do you think Jesus knew that was going to happen? That they were going to call that curse down on themselves? Sure, he predicted it. He walked around saying of their temple that not one stone was going to be left on another, that it was going to be completely razed to the ground, and that they, who had always been a national people, were going to be scattered. And that happened in 70 AD. Titus the Roman general came in, and they leveled that temple, effectively ending 1,400 years of a sacrificial system in national Israel that came to a screeching halt in 70 AD when they no longer had the tools and the implements and the place to do it. There was no more holiest place. There was no more temple. And Jesus told them that was going to happen. And here they made it their fault. Isn't that interesting? Jesus said it was going to happen. And they, of their own supposed free will, hated him and brought the curse down upon themselves. Now, we've got 2,000 years of history we can look back on. And of the people groups of the world, there are a lot of people groups who have been wiped out, who have been punished, who have been sacrificed. You can name a lot of different people groups that were here for a while and then weren't anymore. Find a Hittite. Try to find me a Jebusite. There are people groups that have been on the planet that for all practical purposes are now gone. Find a Jew. It's easy. They're scattered all over the world. Israelites are all over the world, and yet there's never been a more systematically persecuted group of people in history than the Jews. But they're the ones who said, bring the curse down on us and on our children. And it did. That curse has fallen on them and falls on them and falls on them. Let's see, Hitler was what, 60 years ago?
From the time I was 10 till I was 16, that was nothing but I knew.
There are people in this room right now that were alive when 6 million Jews were systematically eradicated. It's hard for us to think of. I had a friend, a roommate out in Los Angeles for a little while, whose parents had the tattooed number on their wrists. They were on the train on their way to Auschwitz when the war ended. People who are alive today can remember those days, which means even to this generation, the Jews continue to be persecuted and this curse continues to fall on them. And yet, the faithfulness of God is such that because they are his chosen people, he's never eradicated them. And in fact, throughout the Old Testament, he continues to promise them that he will never be completely finished with them. Oh, sure, he's going to punish them. He's going to blind them. They're not going to recognize their Messiah. Paul, writing in Romans 11, goes so far as to say that they are enemies of the gospel for your sake, for the sake of the Gentiles. And yet, as touching the election, they are beloved. For the Father's sake, it's remarkable. These are people who have been enemies of the gospel ever since the gospel landed on planet Earth. And yet Paul would write that as touching the election, they are beloved because of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and the promises that God made to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. And therefore, as long as there are sun and moon in their orbits, as long as there are waves crashing into beaches on planet Earth, God will never, ever give up on the Israelites. Jeremiah 31 says so. Paul says so in Romans 11. It's a remarkable bit of sovereignty that these people would say, all right then, let his blood be on us and on our children. And God took them at their word. And ever since then, they have suffered like no people group on the planet. And because God is faithful, he's never eradicated them. Now, by the way, long as you're in this frame of mind where you recognize the faithfulness of God to faithless people who he continues to sustain simply because he made a promise to them, he made a promise to Abraham, and therefore he is sustaining Israel to this very day, the good news for you and me is he made a promise to his son, who is greater than Abraham. And he said to his son that his son would have a people, and that they would never perish, that he would never abandon them, he would never leave them, he would never forsake them. And so yet again, we have a promise greater than the promise made to Abraham, and we can rest assured on that, because boy, if you learn anything from looking at the history of Israel, this is why I keep saying you can't understand history if you don't understand your Bible. If we've learned anything from looking at the history of Israel, it's that God is faithful to the people he has called and elected. Paul says it again in Romans 11. He says, the gifts and calling of God are without repentance. That means God never turns from his gifts or his calling. If he has called you, if he has gifted you, he never turns from that. And the history of the world shows that he has been faithful to his chosen people, Israel, and is to this day. Therefore, we have every reason to believe that he's going to continue to be faithful to the people he has promised to his son.
And his history will be faithful too, but he's promised to David.
Absolutely.
Of his seed with the king sit, will reign the whole earth.
And have an everlasting kingdom.
Right.
And reign over all the nations. Yeah, those promises are all there. Those promises are all good.
The world that's coming. That's the world I'm looking for.
You and me both, sister.
problems are going to be over.
New heaven, new earth, new back, new knees, new hair. It's going to be good. New hips. New hearts. It's going to be good. It's going to be good. All right. So the people answered and said, his blood be on us and on our children. Then he released Barabbas for them. But after having Jesus scourged, he delivered him to be crucified. Turn quickly to Mark 15. We'll just cover Mark because it's very similar to Matthew. We'll pick up in Luke next week, and that'll take us back to John. Mark runs very parallel to Matthew, but it's kind of a condensed version. But he throws in a couple of extra little facts. Chapter 15, verse 1, "And early in the morning, the chief priests with the elders and the scribes and the whole council immediately held a consultation, and binding Jesus, they led him away and delivered him up to Pilate. And Pilate questioned him and said, 'Are you the king of the Jews?' And answering, he said to him, 'You said it.' And the chief priests began to accuse him harshly. And Pilate was questioning him again, saying, 'Do you make no answer? See how many charges they bring against you.' But Jesus made no further answer, so that Pilate was amazed. Now at the feast, he used to release for them any one prisoner whom they requested. And the man named Barabbas had been imprisoned with the insurrectionists who had committed murder in the insurrection." Now we get a bigger picture of this Barabbas guy. This is a really bad guy. John said he was a robber, is the translation. Mark lets you know he's a murderer, he's a seditionist, not a good guy, and everybody in the community knew he was that bad a guy. But when given the choice between him back in the community or Jesus, who walked around feeding, healing, teaching, I mean, you would think any rational person would say, let us have the healer back, because that was good when he was in our community. That was helpful. But you know that guy that goes around killing people? He's not good for our community. So maybe keep him and give us the healer back. And instead they said, give us the killer. At this point they were so blinded, they thought the murderer was better than the Prince of Life. That's how twisted these people were by now. And remember, a week earlier, it's all, Hosanna, Son of David. A week later, it's, give us the murderer. What depravity. Verse 8, "And the multitude went up and began asking him to do as he had been accustomed to do for them." That means give them somebody back. "And Pilate answered, saying, 'Do you want me to release for you the King of the Jews?' For he was aware that the chief priests had delivered him up because of envy." In other words, Jesus was building a following. And they, of course, were the leaders in Jerusalem. They were the ones who had managed to become rich on the back of these people. And of course, remember how Jesus described them. They loved to be seen in the market, walking around with their broad phylacteries. They loved to make big prayers in the middle of a marketplace, on a corner where everybody could hear them. Even when they would make a gift, a sacrifice, when they would give an offering in the temple, they made sure that people blew trumpets first so that everybody would go, oh, trumpets, what's happening over there? And then they could watch these guys give their offering. I mean, they love to be seen of men. They love the glory that they got from other people. And then this young upstart shows up. And he's walking around doing miracles. Next thing you know, he's got a following. And not only does he have a crowd, but he's telling the crowd how bad the Pharisees are. So they have a vested interest in getting rid of him. But Pilate knows they're doing this out of jealousy. After all, this is the same Pontius Pilate who has a couple of times appeared in front of Caesar looking for a better job than ruling this area of the world. Because this was not an area that anybody wanted to deal with. It was a powder keg. He understands what it is to try to get political comeuppance. And he realizes that that's all the Pharisees are doing. They're jealous because they don't like the fact that Jesus has a following and he's talking against them. And Pilate gets that. "For he was aware," verse 10, "for he was aware that the chief priests had delivered him up because of envy, but the chief priests stirred up the multitude to ask him to release Barabbas for them instead. And answering again, Pilate was saying to them, 'Then what shall I do to him whom you call the King of the Jews?'" Notice how often Pilate keeps using that phrase. He doesn't call him Jesus of Nazareth. The charge against him is, according to the Jews, that he called himself king. And that would be an act of rebellion against Caesar, who is both God and king. in the Roman dominion. So if he's actually setting himself up to be king, then that's a problem for the Romans. This is a political problem. But Pilate keeps using the phrase, back at them, which I just think is funny. Because he keeps saying to them, do you want me to give you back the king of the Jews? Who do you want me to release for you? The king of the Jews? He keeps calling him the king of the Jews, which is just starting to tick the Jews off, especially the leaders. They're just getting frustrated with this. When he dies, Pilate makes sure that they write in an inscription over his head, the king of the Jews, in three languages, so that everybody can read it. They put it in Latin, because that's the language of the Romans. They put it in Greek, because that's the language of the street. And they put it in Hebrew, so that the Jews get to read it every day. King of the Jews. So the leaders, the Jewish leaders, come to him and say, no, don't write that. Write, he said he was the king of the Jews. And Pilate says, what I wrote, I wrote. He keeps sticking it in their face. King of the Jews, king of the Jews. And by the way, I think it's one of the reasons Pilate's a little afraid to mess with him. What if it turns out he is? So they shouted back, crucify him. But Pilate was saying to them, why? What evil has he done? But they shouted all the more, crucify him. And wishing to satisfy the multitude, Pilate released Barabbas for them. And after having Jesus scourged, he delivered him to be crucified. The scourging was a pretty typical part of a Roman crucifixion. But oftentimes it was done to punish a criminal. I think in this case, Pilate was hoping that they would see how badly he had been scourged and they would say, okay, that's enough. I have to tell you a little bit about Roman scourging just to brighten up the morning and then we're done. The typical way that a person was scourged was that they were tied to a pole so that they were forced to stay upright, so they couldn't shrink away from it. Oftentimes with their arms outstretched around the pole so that their back was open. And they would use either a cat of nine tails, you've probably heard that word before, or a short stick with four leather bands on it. And tied into the leather bands would be pieces of sharp bone and glass, things that could tear and rip and hook. And the hooking part was part of the goal. And so once you were strapped to the pole, these Roman centurions who were big guys who make an art of doing this, who know how to hand out a beating, they begin tearing the skin off you using these whips. So not only was your skin lacerated by the leather, but torn apart by the bone and the glass that would hook and tear. It was very common for muscle, sinew, bone to be exposed. It was very common for people to just die during the beating. That's what they did to Jesus, apparently in the hope that the people would say, that's good enough. But then after they did it, they began mocking him. We'll look at that next week. But picture this for a moment. Picture your back being that lacerated. And then they throw a heavy curtain over you, a purple curtain, and beat you in the face with a reed. Remember a couple of years ago when there was the young boy in Singapore who was caned? And there was the uproar, the international uproar, because caning was just so cruel. Okay, well, that's what it was. They caned Jesus after the scourging. In the face, while they ripped his beard out, while they blindfolded him and punched him in the face till he was black and blue. And then the crown of thorns. And then they took a chunk of wood and put it across his lacerated back so that they could march him through dusty streets where the dust would get into the sores and into his back. I'm telling you, you haven't begun to suffer for your sin the way he suffered for your sin. And as bad as all of that beating was, which we'll continue to look at the next couple of weeks, as bad as all that was, It wasn't as bad as what he endured for 3 hours on the cross. And you, you haven't even bled resisting your sin. Yeah, it's tough. It's tough being human. It's tough being flesh. It's tough resisting sin. It's tough doing what's right. I agree. But you haven't yet begun to resist the way Christ resisted for you. You haven't begun to understand the depth of your depravity or the height of God's holiness until you look at what the price was that was exacted to fill in that breach between you and God. The more you see and the more you understand of how horrendous what he went through is, the more you'll see how black your sin was and how remarkably loving and gracious and redemptive your Lord is. And the deeper I can stress this and the more I can help you feel it, the more you're going to come away saying, it's just amazing grace. It's just amazing grace that he would do that for me. Because he didn't deserve it. You did. But he took it. Next week, we'll start in Luke's account. Luke is the only one who tells us that for a short period, Pilate sent Jesus to go see King Herod. Because remember, what we read in Acts 4:28 was that Pilate and Herod were involved. Luke's the only one who fills in that blank and tells us about Herod. And then we'll get to John, and we're going to see several more instances of fulfilled prophecy describing what Jesus is going to go through. To the point where we will ultimately end up in Isaiah. Because one of the most remarkable aspects of the four Gospels, I promise I'm quitting now. One of the most remarkable aspects of the four Gospels, okay, I promise I'm quitting in 3 minutes. One of the most remarkable aspects of the Gospels is that they can only describe the outside activity that they could witness. But to understand the theology of what happened at the cross, you have to go back to Isaiah, who wrote 700 years before Jesus. Isaiah wrote down the theology of the transfer of guilt and the substitutionary death, but the Gospels, they just witness the outward occurrences, just what happens. But you have to know the whole Bible to know what really took place at Calvary. That's all coming. That's all coming attractions. That should be enough to get you back here. You understand me?
Yep.
All right, good.
On behalf of everyone at Grace Christian Assembly, we thank you for listening to this week's Salvation by Grace message. Remember to visit us on the internet at www.salvationbygrace.org. And we invite you to join us next time when we gather around the Word and study the sovereign grace of God.